Hello, and thank you for listening. This is Elgin Chow, Director of Benchmarks and Indices at TMX Datalinx, TMX's Information Services Division. Welcome to TMX Presents, the podcast. This is where we have conversations with capital markets leaders and visionaries from around the world. In today's episode, I'll be speaking with Pavan Sukhdev, a pioneering figure renowned for his work and thought leadership in environmental economics. Coupled with an academic background in physics and a career in banking, Pavan is guided by a dual passion, making visible the invisible economics of nature and redefining corporate performance. Part of Pavan's accolades include serving as special advisor and head of UNEP's Green Economy Initiative. He was also the study leader for the Economics of Ecosystem and Biodiversity, or TEEB for short, a study commissioned by the G8 Plus 5 that quantified the economic and human costs of biodiversity loss, offering actionable solutions for policymakers. In recognition of his contributions, Pavan was awarded the prestigious McCluskey Fellowship by Yale University, at which he taught a course on TEEB and authored a book, Corporation 2020. Today, Pavan continues his mission as the founder and CEO of Just Impact, a leading data and analytics provider dedicated to measuring and quantifying impact. And as a side note, this data is available for our listeners to preview on the TMX ESG Data Hub. So Pavan, welcome to TMX Presents, and thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So to kick things off, maybe we start with a bit of background. For the longest time, at least for as long as I've observed the sustainability space, it seemed like sustainability was an afterthought in the financial markets. And it was like a band of outsiders looking in, a lot of people from NGOs, academia, knocking on doors, telling the typical power players, the bankers, the traders, the portfolio managers that, hey, this sustainability stuff actually matters. It matters to the way we evaluate, invest, and transact with companies. But you were very much an insider. You were a banker for a large part of your career. So what made you see the light, so to speak? Like, what drove you to start thinking about how we should be pricing in these sustainability risks and opportunities?
Yeah, again, that's a good observation, you know. As a banker, I still remember being passionate about sustainability because I had woken up to the invisible economics of nature and the fact that we didn't appreciate value until it transacted in market. So that was my personal wake-up call, driven by, among other things, most importantly, the birth of my first child and the fact that she appreciated nature and that had value and there was no price. And vice versa, I could see the destruction of forests around me in my country in India. And that is again an example of value being destroyed because there is no price. So I kind of got it from a different angle. But the mainstream of the banking world didn't really get this. They thought it was just one of those, like you said, things at the periphery, an add-on, something nice to have, not necessary. Because to be honest, their business didn't depend on it. And in some ways, it was only with the slow increase in the noise level from asset owners, in other words, the sovereign wealth funds, the family offices, the high net worth private individuals who had a view on sustainability, that this began to change. Because these asset owners started bombarding their asset managers with requests saying, we want to know not just the performance financially, but also the performance in terms of sustainability or in terms of greening the economy of the assets that you've put into our portfolio. And it was only when the asset managers further got their heads around, and way back in 2004, a conference was launched called Who Cares Wins by the IFC and the Global Compact, the UN Global Compact, together with 20 major asset managers and asset owners. It was only then that people started thinking, okay, maybe there is a need to start reflecting sustainability, impacts such as environmental impacts and social impacts, drivers such as good and bad governance. Insert those into the mix that you report to your asset owners, well, to your first to the asset managers and then to the asset owners. So this was the reason for this. It was the structure of the financial markets and the fact that the asset owners' voices were not being heard early enough or loudly enough that led to this delay that you talk about.
And what changed amongst the asset owners? Why did they just, I shouldn't say they started suddenly taking notice of these things, but what changed in their way of thinking such that they wanted to co-opt these sustainability issues in the way they approach the markets?
Yeah, that's another great question. And it was a couple of things that changed at the same time, pretty much. One is that the high net worth individuals who were running major businesses began to be old enough to have children. And the children were feeding back to their parents saying, "Dad or Mom, don't you know about climate change? We heard in class about climate change. You know, we can't do things that cause more climate change." We, as in the business, of course. So this was, if you like, a generational divide that was playing out under our noses. The older generation thought the important thing was to create capital, physical capital, what we call produced capital, in the words of the economists. And that was fine because it generated GDP growth. GDP growth was value addition. Value addition was measured in markets. But here was something that was not measured in markets. So now how the hell does the mother or the father respond to her bright youngster who's telling her that she's got her business model all wrong because it doesn't generate human, social, and especially natural capital, but actually destroys natural capital, is pretty neutral or uncertain on social capital, and she's not sure how much human capital is generating. So the conversations changed, and I think that was one, the generational push. And the other thing that happened was the wiser and the more successful of the asset owners, those who'd made it big in their respective businesses, wanted to place their money in ways, and they understood that their business had been built on the back of externalities. In other words, on inflicting social costs, such as air pollution and water pollution and climate change and so on. They knew that they had, if you like, made money the wrong way. So what they wanted to do was to invest the money the right way. Let's not repeat our mistakes twice over in our own lifetimes. And then they started talking to their asset manager, saying, "It's not good enough for you to give us just S&P 500 or MSCI ACWI as the index. It's not good enough for us to have just tracking funds. Either give us a fund to track, which is sustainable, or tell us you're going to asset manage in an active way and then tell us what your strategy is. It's not good enough what you're doing." So that dissatisfaction with how the money, the wealth that they had made was invested, was actually also driving. So there were these two things that happened pretty much at the same time. And that was that's what we saw playing out in the early part of the 20th century. Gen Z talking to their parents, and the parents also realizing that, we can't make this mistake twice.
Mm-hmm. So I want to focus on that first piece for a bit, that difference in generational outlook. So a lot of times when people talk about things like ESG investing, they talk about investing with your values or reflecting your values in your portfolios. And that's sort of what the ESG pundits use to get people on board. It's like we're going to have this huge generational transfer of wealth from the baby boomers to the millennials to the Gen Zs. And at each step, they're going to want their values reflected differently. And in so much as these generations, these newer generations care about things like climate change, these things should be reflected in the way we invest. But your area of focus, impact, goes beyond just ESG. So maybe for our listeners, can you help us make that distinction, the distinction between ESG investing versus impact investing or impact measurement?
Absolutely. Impact measurement and investment impact, actually. So firstly, what is ESG? It's environmental, social, and governance. Environmental and social impacts are impacts. In other words, an impact is a change in human well-being as a result of the activities of a corporation and its value chain. So impact metrics are all about measuring the impacts and economically valuing them. And that's what we mean by impact economics. It's really the economics of impacts. In other words, quantitatively, how much is the economic loss or gain to people other than the counterpart in the transaction? Supposing I'm Volkswagen, I make cars, I sell cars, I make a profit, I'm happy. You, Elgin, drive your cars, take your family and friends around, you're happy. But we didn't account for the externalities of our transaction because, you know, the emissions of our car partly was responsible for causing climate changing effects such as storms and cyclones, floods and droughts, which destroys property near the sea, which could damage person X. And we didn't account for the fact that that small little algorithm that I had, which switched off the emissions, the diesel emissions of my car when it's tested, resulted in more diesel fumes, which resulted in lung diseases for some of the people, not me, not you, but people on the streets. So we had inflicted health costs as externalities, we had inflicted climate costs as externalities, and we weren't accounting for either. Now, this situation is really untenable. And that's what I do nowadays. I basically work out what is the overall impact of a corporation, not just the profits for shareholders, which is part of impacts, but also the training and development for staff, and indeed the impacts on the health of staff based on my policies, and the impacts on the nature that I use and consume, or the nature that I affect as a result of my activities. And last, in some ways, perhaps the most important, the overall social capital impacts. In other words, what have I done to either rip apart the fabric of society or to consolidate it and make it healthier and longer lasting? All of these things are measurable. Natural, human, and produced capital impacts are measured in terms of capital asset pricing model, present value or future incomes either increased or decreased. And social capital is measured in its absence, because if you don't have social capital, then natural capital assets get consumed due to the tragedy of the commons. Human capital doesn't get made because employers are not investing in their employees, or if they are, or even being careless with their employees. And social capital and produced capital gets less because the company is less effective making money. So human, produced, and natural capital can be measured using CAPM logic. Social capital cannot, but in its absence, all of the other three capitals produce less. These are the ways that I use to measure the impacts of a corporation. So, long answer to a short question, what's the difference between ESG and impacts? Needs an understanding of what is an impact, and that's what is at the heart of impact economics, which is what I've just explained. But there's two more quick points. One is that, remember, ESG, ENS are already impacts. The problem with ESG metrics is that they're not calculating using science the actual impacts. This much emissions means how much damage in coastal infrastructure and how much damage in terms of storms and cyclones on land and so on. Or this much air pollution quantity, SOx, NOx, PM 2.5, PM 10 from a cement factory cause how much health damage to the people who live downwind of that cement factory. These are the things that impact economics assumes have to be calculated. You can't take a view saying, oh, well, I rate the cement factories air pollution as 4 out of 5. Oh, no, no. The CEO is Elgin, a nice guy. Make it 3 out of 5. I can't do any of that. I have to calculate. I have to go log into Copernicus or NASA, work out wind speeds and wind directions, work out where do the particles like PM 2.5 and 10 land? Where do the molecules diffuse to? How far? How many people are living in the locations where they go? How much is the worsening of their health thanks to respiratory and cardiovascular diseases? I have to calculate all that. And this is what my company actually does. We calculate all these impacts using nothing except science, physics, chemistry, and biology. This is what ESG does not do. It puts ratings. A rating is an opinion. An impact is an impact. Frankly, I think even the European Commission, despite the best intentions, is getting confused these days because they've got a regulation I read recently which includes impacts as part of ratings. Well, my friends, it's not. Please don't make that mistake.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the leg that the ESG naysayers stand on. It's that it's not scientific. So do you think that science is what's necessarily to drive adoption of, or drive the integration of impact into the way we invest and evaluate companies?
Well, there's value in opinions and there's value in fact, right? Mm-hmm. The value of opinions is if you say, okay, I'm in the cement sector, what should I be worried about? And sure, you can look at your ESG ratings and they'll tell you to worry about GHG emissions because mm-hmm. such is the nature of the stoichiometry of making cement. You can't make one molecule of calcium oxide without burning effectively one molecule of calcium carbonate. And then what you get from it is one molecule of carbon dioxide. So you need to know the science to understand the impact that's going to happen. And you can describe that. And that's part of, you know, an understanding of the business of cement. But when you want to calculate how much is the cost, in other words, how much is the social cost of air pollution from a cement factory? You can't use a rating for that. There's no mm-hmm. point telling people, oh, well, it's 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 5. That doesn't make any sense, right? Because that doesn't give you any information. That just tells you that, yeah, it's kind of high. And we don't know what is high. But you do know what is high. That's the whole point. You can calculate it.
Yeah, and without an exact figure, how do you avoid the risks?
Correct. What do you do? What do you do is if you take 3 out of 5, 4 out of 5, and you add it up with all kinds of other ratings of all kinds of other things like water usage and greenhouse gas emissions and how many board meetings you have a year and whether your board is sensitized to materiality or sensitized to the environment, you come mm-hmm. to a magic answer, 42. Mm-hmm. The answer, as those who've read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the answer to life, the universe, and everything, right? Now, that's not very useful. What am I supposed to do with 42? I'm the chief executive, or I'm the head of operations. I need to know, okay, fine, so I've got 15 factories. What do I do? If I were to put the pollution screening devices at the tops of my factory funnels, would that help? Yes, it would. How much? Well, you can work that out, and so on. So you need to know real things in order to take real actions. That's the bit that ESG doesn't do. ESG is a way of discovering, if you're a newbie, if you're kind of new into the space, don't really understand sustainability, want to know what it's all about, want to have a broad picture, how does a company treat its people, human capital, social capital, how does it affect the environment, yeah, greenhouse gas emissions, water usage, and air pollution. Yes, all this ESG metrics will include. The how much question, or how much in terms of quantity, and the how much in terms of economic costs, that ESG cannot produce. And it was not meant for that. It was meant for learning about sectors. It wasn't meant for understanding the impacts of a corporation. But unfortunately, it's being used, misused, in my opinion. And that's why I tend to agree with the naysayers, because what they are complaining about may be different from what I'm complaining about. I'm complaining about the misuse of ESG factors. They are just complaining from mainly an ideological standpoint, and some from a theoretical standpoint about ESG as an approach. I don't think the ESG approach is what my problem is. My problem is its misuse for working out impacts, and that it cannot do.
Agreed. So I want to explore this interplay between the externalities that you alluded to earlier and materiality. So I checked out one of your earlier TED Talks, and in it, you gave the example of how the Amazon is actually a rain factory. And I'm probably going to butcher the example, but you said there are these weather systems that move over top, collecting the water underneath, and then they release it in the form of precipitation in the surrounding areas, thereby acting as part of the agricultural economy of the countries like Brazil. All right. So if you take that example and you look at the allocation of risk, you'll see that the perpetrators of the risk, or the source of the risk, i.e. the people and the corporations responsible for deforesting the Amazon, they aren't the ones necessarily experiencing the negative impacts of those risks. So how do we turn the tables and how do we restructure it in a way where the perpetrators are the ones that are materially being affected by these risks?
Well, you've put a great question and a great challenge to me and to everyone who's listening, because this is actually the problem. You see, if you replant the forest, and many people are doing that, I've done that myself, right, in my private lands in Australia. So replanting the forest will generate rainforest, and the rainforest will have evapotranspiration, as do the rainforests of the Amazon. And by the way, the Amazonian rainforest evapotranspirate an estimated 20 billion tons of water vapor into the atmosphere every day. That's something. Of course, my little private experiment is tiny. But the point is, neither the Amazonas state, which houses most of the Amazon rainforest, nor my own little block of 14 hectares way back in Australia, can tell the evapotranspiration, the clouds that form. We can't tell the clouds where to rain. It's not going to rain on my block. It may not even rain in the Amazon. It actually rains in Uruguay, Paraguay, Mato Grosso, and provides agricultural output for these states and these countries. So it's not the Amazon state that did the rainforest protection, or me and my little block in North Queensland that generated a bit of water vapor. We are not the ones benefiting, because we cannot tell the clouds where to rain. Such is the nature of public goods. And this is where markets cannot solve all problems on the planet. Markets are great at discovering prices. Markets are great at providing an opportunity to punish the misallocation of capital if you let them, right? But markets are not great at solving social problems. That's not what they're made for. So let's be real about this, and let's say that, okay, markets can solve what they can solve, you know, capital allocation, punishing of misallocation, and so on. And let's get to the regulators and the policymakers to solve what they can solve, which is to set policies and prices, including taxes, that will correct the misincentive that prevails today. Today, externalities of corporations are upwards of $10 trillion. $11 trillion was the last estimate that I saw, in terms of negative impacts on society. Just the top 3,000 corporations have externalities in excess of $2 to $2.5 trillion. So with this size of social costs inflicted by companies, the only way to make them pay for it or to stop producing more social costs is to stop the free lunch, which means ensure, number one, that you measure these externalities. Number two, that you report them to people who care. And this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, reporting them to the asset owners, not just the asset managers who are conduits, but to the asset owners via the asset managers. And last but not the least, to policymakers, so they can say, well, maybe it's not such a good idea to have hundreds of billions of dollars of health cost trying to be all things to all people. And maybe we should just set a penalty or a rule which says that, you know, this kind of business will be imposed a certain additional tax, or this other kind of business cannot simply do what it's doing because it is damaging human health. So time has come for policymaking to take an interest in externalities. And that's been rather slow, mainly because of corporate capture.
And I'm sure it was a bit challenging to pin you down for this podcast because you were in India, you were in Australia, you moved between the UK and Switzerland quite often. So you've got a pretty global perspective of what it takes to drive positive impact. Yeah. So what do we need to do on a macro scale to achieve higher adoption or higher rates of recognition for these impact issues?
Well, I think step one is, and it's kind of beginning to happen. I mean, there are a few changes that are beginning to happen. One is this, what I call impact schizophrenia, which is declining. There's lots of people who still are having conversations or so-called conversations with each other, where one is talking about impact investing, which is basically the $1.1 trillion of assets, mainly credit, which are invested in small SMEs who are busy trying new business ideas to solve big social problems. And I wish them well, and I'm inspired by them. But those are inspirational, but they're not going to make change happen because the volumes, the size is too small. And then out of the global assets of about 250 trillion, there's the remaining 99.6%, which is essentially big companies, the rest of the world, if you like. And I'm more concerned about making sure that the rest of the world cannot continue to have the free lunch at the expense of society of $11 trillion per annum or thereabouts, which it is having these days. And that can only happen with the help of policymaking and investing. If investing can get their act together, and that's the direction I'm particularly interested in, then we will see corporations waking up and we will see the public waking up because the corporations have woken up. So that's the direction I'm choosing. I do understand that today's corporations, especially those with vested interests, I mean, look at the oil sector, right? You've got so much power in the oil sector that you can read the statistics, they're all over the press in terms of the number of oil and gas representatives that were at the last COP, or indeed that will be at this COP this year, compared to the representatives of the islands in the Pacific Ocean that are drowning as a result of the emissions and climate change caused by oil and gas. So you kind of understand that the power equation is not balanced by any stretch of the imagination. There's no point hoping that the United Nations is going to solve this because most of the countries who have oil and gas, the OPEC group and so on, will basically side with their corporations because they're the ones who pay their taxes and they're the ones who provide employment and they're the ones who provide money when it comes to election time. So that's not going to change. That's reality. Let's get used to it. So what is going to change? What's going to change is the way investors, especially right-minded investors such as sovereign wealth funds who pursue a public purpose, high net worth individuals who've made it big in their industry and understand the importance of externalities and have the conscience and the guts to go ahead and say, right, I want to invest my money in companies which do not have large negative externalities. I don't want oil and gas. I don't want tobacco. I don't want certain car industries. I don't want certain this and certain that. Make those demands. When they make those demands, that's when people like me have to do the calculations of impact provided to them. And then we begin to see change happening because the pressure of investment is powerful. Where your money comes from, where your next equity or debt issuance goes and whose pockets it lands matters hugely to every chief executive and every chief finance officer. They're the first place to apply pressure. The next place is going to be to policymakers. When they realize that the football field has become somewhat even because you now don't only have corporations with vested interests plying their trade, but you also have investors saying, no, you can't keep doing this.
And on the note of getting in front of investors as part of this partnership between TMX Datalinx and Just Impact, we've actually gotten you guys in front of a lot of our large asset owner, asset manager clients. And the conversations nowadays are largely focused on biodiversity. So what's spurning the recent interest in biodiversity?
Well, I'm going to give you a surprising answer. The surprising answer is COVID.
Really? Okay.
It took a long time for people to wake up to the reality of climate breakdown, and now they have, thanks to fantastic work by people in the investor segment like yourselves, and thanks to the NGOs and so on and so forth. But biodiversity was just not moving. And it's maybe the way that it's been framed. It should have been framed as nature. And even after that reframing, which was done by the NGOs in the last decade, it still wasn't moving in the minds of people until COVID happened. And suddenly people understood, what is nature? Nature is that little microbe that can kill off 4 million people. Nature has a lot of power in providing us a space to live in which is habitable versus providing us a space to live in which is completely impossible to live. They sort of woke up to nature thanks to the jolt of COVID. And that's a good thing, and it's the terrible tragedy that people's lives had to be lost for this to happen. But it has happened. So now we have a greater awareness of nature. Now the question is, how do you play that awareness into policy, into investment decision making, and into corporate policies and corporate models, business models that are positive on nature and regenerative of nature? Because at the end of the day, nature is what provides a huge part of our economies. Everything in the room where you sit or the room that I sit is either pulled out from nature in terms of mining or is grown by nature, wood and so on. Everything that we enjoy, such as an inclement climate, a climate in which we can habit, is basically because of the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle being appropriately balanced by the size of nature that resides on the planet's surface. So if you change this balance, if you push things to tipping points, and we are pushing boundaries, planetary boundaries, beyond, up to and beyond their tipping points, then we have a nature which is gutted and is unable to support human life, let alone any other kind of life. That's the realization, I think, that has dawned on many people, that it's important to maintain the current state of nature. We've had nature like this only for the honeymoon period of 11,000 years, right? The Anthropocene is a sad new reflection of how the Holocene, which is the epoch that we are in, is still called the Holocene. The Anthropocene is what scientists are saying the next epoch will be, which will be determined by the impacts of humankind, Anthropocene, as in caused by humans. So we don't want it going there, frankly, because it's an unpleasant, uncomfortable world for literally hundreds of millions of people, if not billions.
Mm-hmm. I really like how you summarized it in the past. I think you had a line in one of your earlier talks that said, nature is the fabric of our society.
Nature is the living fabric of this planet. If you tear that fabric, then you're destroying that living fabric. You're destroying yourselves.
Mm-hmm. So let's bring this conversation back to the markets. It seems like as an environmental issue, it's not as readily understandable as the relationship between emissions and climate change. And just now we're starting to understand the disruptions that climate change has on our lives and our businesses. So what are the implications of biodiversity loss on the financial markets?
Yeah. So to repeat for your audience, biodiversity is the living fabric of this planet. Its ecosystems, its species, and its genes. All of that together is known as biodiversity. It's not just the diversity of ecosystems and the huge diversity of species and the even greater diversity of genetic material, but it's also the quantity. Quantity matters, especially when it comes to ecosystems. There's no point having a small patch of forest and expecting it to produce enough rainfall to feed your agricultural systems. That's not going to work. Quantity matters. So as we destroy quantity, even if we preserve diversity, it's not going to help. We need both. We need diversity and quantity. So the question is, how do we ensure this? And I think this is where rules and regulations and greater levels of awareness and the ability to pass back costs to the producer of those problems becomes really important. But look at how significant these effects on biodiversity are and from how many different kinds of businesses they can arise. Now, let me begin by saying that sometimes we blame people whom we can see, but not the people whom we can't. And such is the nature of nature. The economic invisibility of nature has been a big passion of mine. How do we solve it? And of course, we need to understand what is economically visible and invisible. But let's take a case in point. Lots of things destroy nature. We tend to look at the obvious ones. Mining, yes. Wherever you mine, there is destruction, unless it's done very carefully. Wherever you grow crops, unless it's done in a sustainable, natural way, you will typically tend to destroy nature. Wherever you deforest for the sake of logging, for the timber industry, you will destroy nature. Wherever you have infrastructure development in place of nature, you will destroy nature. And wherever you have the wrong kinds of tourism, which are intrusive tourism, you will destroy nature. But apart from these five sectors, there are very few sectors that have direct negative impacts on nature. And yet nature is being destroyed at a calamitous pace. 1% of rainforests or forests overall getting destroyed, 1.5 to 2% of wetlands getting destroyed every year. These are the realities that we live in these days. Now, is this all because of mining, agriculture, forestry, and bad tourism? And the answer is no. It's because of all kinds of things. If you look at power, for instance, you may have a large power producer, which for the sake of argument has 100 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions. I'm referring to an actual one in Europe, actually. It has 100 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions. It's based in France and Italy. It uses 2.3 cubic kilometers of fresh water every year. So it does have a significant impact on nature because this company has got mainly fossil fuel fired power plants. And those fossil fuel power plants are basically generating 100 million tons of the greenhouse gas emissions, which are causing rainforest dieback in the Amazon and in Indonesia. Its water usage, because remember, it uses the water as coolant, means that the water that goes back into the same rivers where it gets it from is a few degrees higher than when the water it took. So therefore, there is a damage impact on riverine biodiversity. These are what we call indirect impacts on biodiversity, right? So the impacts are not just because of five sectors. They're because of literally every sector that has a significant use of nature indirectly, not just directly, or impact on nature indirectly, not just directly. And I think that's what we have to watch out for. We have to ensure that we measure nature impacts in a way that includes both the direct and the indirects. And today, there is really only one yardstick that does it properly, and that's known as PDF, potentially disappeared fraction. And that's exactly what we are proposing to share with our investor friends and our corporate friends. And indeed, through TMX, we are proposing to share that. So that's basically how we are helping to solve this problem. See, you cannot manage what you do not measure. Step one of any problem is if you don't measure it, you will never manage it. And step one of the problem solution is measure it. We need to measure potentially disappeared fraction of species in order that we can manage it down to levels which is not as devastating as before.
From Mark Tao earlier, you said ESG investing is almost ideologically driven. And when I think about investing more generally, it is an optimistic behavior or practice, right? Because why would you lock away a dollar today if you weren't optimistic for the future?
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. And ESG investing, especially since it focuses on a lot of ESG risks, tends to be very negative. And I think that might be why you see this conflict between investors more broadly and ESG. It's that, you know, investors are optimistic about the future, whereas the ESG pundits tend to take on a very negative tone, yeah. Right? So let's leave the audience with something more positive,
sure.
Right? What are you most optimistic about? And what's ultimately going to unlock value in the future if we get it right, if we're able to drive positive impact in the right ways?
Absolutely. And you hit the key words needed, positive impact. Mm-hmm. So now, what is impact? As I said, in impact economics, it's the change in human well-being as a result of the activities of a corporation and its value chain. How many different ways are there in which an impact can change? Broadly, there are four capital metrics. Human capital, that's knowledge, skills, and health. Natural capital, that's all that's in nature, ecosystem, species, and genes. Social capital, that's the formal and informal institutions that bind us together as a society. And of course, produced capital that belongs to the shareholders. Now, human well-being is increased if all four of these capitals are increased, not just in absolute terms, but on average. In other words, people on average should be wealthier. And the Gini coefficient, you know, as they say, should be going down, not up. So basically, you should have a more equitable distribution of wealth between people. To get all this to happen, in other words, better distribution and more wealth, you need to make sure that the impacts of companies are measured in four dimensions and not one. And the beauty is, this is possible. This is possible. That's what impact economics is all about. It's about showing regulators and investors that you can actually work out the impacts of companies and invest in those who are committed to the idea that they need to increase the overall wealth of society, not just the... Of course, they have to increase their shareholders' capital, otherwise no shareholder will want them. But they must also increase the human capital of their employees, the social capital of the countries and communities in which they operate, and the natural capital of the world. So it is this plus, 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 plus philosophy, which I'm saying is possible, and it is possible to measure it. That's what people should focus on today. If we move in the direction of positive impact, as against simply accepting or ignoring or not measuring negative impact, we will never get it right. If we move in the direction of positive impact and begin by starting to measure what are our impacts. Remember, Elgin, on any journey, there are two things that you need to know absolutely. One is, where am I? And two, where do I want to go? You can't desire to go somewhere unless you know where you are. So you need to measure your today's impacts. And then you look ahead and say, okay, in future, I want my impacts to look thus. Lower on the negatives, higher on the positives. And here's five different or three different strategies that I've got, which I'm going to employ in my company to make that happen. And my CFO and my investors have to figure out which of these three or five I adopt. That's the way forward. And that's possible for every company on this planet. Every billion-dollar corporation today is able to do this. I guarantee it to you. And they should.
That's great insight. And I think that's an opportunity to break for now. But I wanted to thank you for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And I wanted to thank the listeners for listening into TMX Presents, the podcast. For more information on the TMX ESG Data Hub, visit tmxinfoservices.com/data-solutions-and-services/products-and-services/TMX-ESG-Data-Hub. And for more insights from capital markets leaders and my TMX colleagues, please visit tmx.com/POV. Again, Pavan, it was great speaking with you. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Elgin. All the best to you and your listeners.